And welcome back to Dad's on the Air, coming to you around Australia on the Community Radio Network. In this program, we bring you informing and entertaining conversations with a wide range of interesting people on topics of fatherhood, family and parenting, men's and boys' issues, and more. Hi, I'm Bill Cable, and our special guest today is Stuart Coop. Stuart is the author of a new book, Paul Kelly, The Man, the Music, and the Life in Between. Stuart is Australia's best music writer, and he examines the life of the Australian music legend, honest, revealing, and a must-have for any Paul Kelly fan. Stuart himself is an author, a music commentator, an independent artist, publicist, and radio broadcaster who has been involved with music all his life. Among the books he's written, edited, or collaborated on are Gdynski and Roadies, when we last had him on the program in 2018. Stuart, welcome to Dad's on the Air.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to talk to you again.
Stuart, Paul Kelly. Now, we're talking about the songwriter, not the footballer, not the journalist, but he wrote his autobiography, How to Make Gravy, in 2010. Does your biography perhaps talk more freely about the bits we like about Paul Kelly?
Look, my book is, of course, I wanted to make it very different from Paul's book, and it says something about Paul Kelly, Bill, that he can write a 600-page memoir and I can write an almost 350-page biography, and there's not much overlap between the two. I wanted to, of course, tell all of the things that were not in Paul's own memoir, and I wanted to do the one thing that, by the very nature of him writing a first-person account of his life, he couldn't do. I wanted to give voice to all of the other people that have been around him through that creative journey. So I didn't reread his book. I didn't go and look at old interviews and old stories. I did more than 100 interviews, new interviews with Paul as well. So I went right back. I spoke to some of his sisters to find out what he was like as a kid, what it was like growing up in the Kelly household, right through all of the people that he played with in early bands, people he went to university with, then all of the people that played with him right through to today. And I spoke to people he's worked with closely, like Archie Roach, Kev Carmody, Neil Finn, Don Walker from Cold Chisel, Renee Geyer, Deborah Conway, pretty much anyone I could find that had some interaction with Paul over the course of his life.
Well, it started off with Paul being one of eight kids growing up in Adelaide. Did he get much support musically from his family?
Well, it was actually nine. He's the sixth of nine. One of the daughters died when she was 9 months old. Yeah, so, but, you know, Paul said we still, you know, describe ourselves as nine children. And initially I thought, no, there's only eight, you know, because I was trying to work out, you know, what was the situation with the nines. But he grew up in a very interesting Adelaide family. His father died when Paul was young, you know, 13, and his father, of course, was young when he passed away. So the eight children were raised by their mother. It sounds like it was a sparky, intellectual thinking family environment. You know, some of the older brothers were chaining themselves to fences and protesting against the moratorium, the Vietnam War, and things of that nature. All of them have gone on to do very interesting, diverse things. Bill, you know, one sister became a nun and did write hymns, and so Paul sort of jokes that he's not the first songwriter in the band. So they were a close family, and they continue to be a very close family. Family is very, very important to Paul, and Paul was gifted is not the best word to use, but look, you know, he was academically very, very smart, but he was also a very, very good Australian rules footballer, a good cricket player. He remains a very competitive tennis player, but he had an environment that was supportive of thinking and working out how you were going to deal with life. You know, he said you were taught to take responsibility for your own actions, and he didn't spend a lot of time at university. He did 6 months at Flinders University. He was there, Flinders University in Adelaide. He was there about a year before I moved from Launceston to go to the same university. And then one of the things I found interesting about Paul is that around those, you know, late teen, early 20 years, he I mean, he came to music late. He didn't start playing guitar until he was 19. He didn't write his first song until he was 20. Prior to that, he was writing poetry and prose for some small Adelaide magazines, particularly one called Another One for Mary. But he also had a fairly nomadic existence there for a few years and not afraid of hard work. He's worked on shipyards. He's worked in mines. He's worked on railways. He travelled to Darwin working. He went up to northern Queensland. He went across to Perth. He did a stint in Kalgoorlie when he played his first ever public performance. He sang two songs at Salamanca Place in Hobart. He was down in Tasmania working on the mines on the west coast. So, you know, he had a lot of early experience which fed into the early songs that he wrote. But he said that he's never been afraid to work, but he realized when he wrote his first song that he was a songwriter. And if he worked and did other jobs, they were purely to allow him to pay his bills and exist and be a songwriter. And he's remained singularly true to that throughout his life.
I think in his youth he played the trumpet, a bit like Paul McCartney, but is it unusual to be picking up a guitar that late, in his late teens like that?
Look, it is a little bit. Yes, he did play the trumpet, a bit like Herb Alpert, I think, too, on his most recent sort of greatest hits collection, Songs from the South. There is a terrific photo of him as a young boy with his trumpet. Look, 19 doesn't seem in some ways to us probably, Bill, and to our listeners maybe old to be picking up a guitar, but, you know, 12, 13, 14, you know, learning guitar, you know, maybe even 16, 17. Look, 19 at the time, it certainly wasn't, you wouldn't say that he was playing guitar from a young age. You know, 19 is not old, of course, but you could certainly say that he came to even learning rudimentary chords on a guitar a little later than most people who pick up the guitar do. Having said that, there are people, you know, in their 50s and 60s who come to the guitar, and, you know, at almost 64, Bill, I haven't given up that I might learn how to play guitar at some stage.
You and me both. some people have said that Paul is perhaps more literary than musical. You mentioned that his father died at that young age. What do you think were the major influences on Paul?
Oh, look, he does have a ferocious intellect. He said, you know, he was very influenced by a group. I mean, the family was very important, you know, very, very important. You know, their discussions, you know, his approach to life. You know, I think there was creativity was encouraged in his family. You know, they weren't poor. They weren't wealthy. You know, they were a solid middle class Adelaide family, you know, and a big family, you know, and people were traveling and going on their first trips overseas and doing bits and pieces, you know, and as the sixth of nine, he had a bunch of older brothers and sisters to talk with, and, you know, he talks about all the different records that the brothers and sisters brought home, you know, of course Bob Dylan records, but Moody Blues records and lots of different things. So I think that fed into it. You know, he's always read a lot, and I think it was a family that had a love of word. You know, it wasn't unnatural for him to be writing, you know, poetry and prose, and it wasn't considered unusual to be carrying books around and reading. You know, that, remember that world where there wasn't the internet and there weren't phones and things like that. You know, if you wanted entertainment and amusement, you read books. And he's continued to do that. You know, he has a prodigious appetite for a very diverse array of music. He keeps very current with music, as well as listening back to music that made decades and decades and decades and decades ago, or hundreds of years ago in some cases. So there's a lot of musicality and there's a lot of love for words, and you couldn't wish for a better combination in a songwriting musician. So, to say that he's one or the other, I think that would be incorrect. But he, you know, he has a great musical brain and a great sense of very understated melody and a very beautiful way of putting words together, you know, and he says in the opening quote of my book, he says, "I'm a songwriter. That's enough. Most people can't do that." Simple aspirations, and he's got very good at those aspirations.
Yeah, look, it's a wonderful cover on the book. I don't know whether it reminds me of James Dean or something, but it's a brooding look at directly at the camera, and a lot of people talk about his looks as well, about his when he had curly hair.
Yes, he had that sort of James Dean, Marlon Brando, young mid-60s Bob Dylan, Lou Reed look about him. That is a terrific photo. I was so pleased that we used that on the cover of the book, because it's taken in 1986, and it's Paul's very first trip to New York City. If you look carefully, you can see the Twin Towers in the background on the left-hand side, and he's actually standing on the Staten Island ferry in New York City when that photo was taken. So, you know, he was a good-looking, as you say, brooding is probably the best word to use, Bill, you know, for what he looked like, you know, in those days as a guy. You know, when that photo was taken, he would have been, you know, early 30s. So, and again, you know, we talk about how he's come to be where he is. I mean, look, you know, we have to also remember, you know, Paul is so much part of the Australian landscape these days. But, you know, he had two records on Mushroom Records that didn't sell very well. And when he did move to Sydney in 1984, you know, he didn't have a record deal. And when his Post album came out in 1985, the record label reluctantly released it. And they weren't committed to releasing even the album that had the now, you know, famous songs like Before Too Long and Darling It Hurts. So he's had a lot of knockbacks, and it takes a fairly steely determination and a focus for someone, you know, to really, after basically three records where people have been going, well, I'm not sure that you're actually that good, not sure that we really want to, you know, continue with you as a recording artist. It takes a bit to keep going, you know, after you've had that thrown at you. But, of course, he did keep going, and here he is now in 2020 at the peak of his popularity.
And we're speaking today with Stuart Coop, who is the author of a new book called Paul Kelly, The Man, The Music and The Life in Between. We might take a short break. Stuart, I'm sure you've got a Paul Kelly song for us that we can listen to.
Oh, look, I mean, where do we start, Bill? But look, you know, Bill, you and I could both spend the next couple of hours debating, you know, a classic Paul Kelly song, and we probably still wouldn't agree. But for a lot of the reasons we've been talking about today, let's have a listen to Adelaide, because, you know, it evokes a lot of what we've been talking about with the young Paul Kelly. There's a reference to his father. There's, you know, he sings about Kensington Road, which is where the family house was. Sings, you know, there's a reference to the statue of Colonel Light. And late in the research for this book, I found out that, you know, he had a very early band that he named Good Enough for the Bush. And one night they did play a ramshackle gig underneath the statue of Colonel Light. And the other thing is, you know, that I love about this song is he sings about, you know, nothing will drag him back to Adelaide. Right. And so this song came out, and there's a terrific story that a couple of years later he was back in Adelaide, and he was watching a test match at the Adelaide Oval, and a burly guy was sitting behind, and he tapped him on the shoulder. He said, "Hey, you, I thought you weren't coming back." Let's have a listen to Adelaide, eh?
1, 2, 3, 4. Wisteria on the back veranda still blooming, and all the great aunts are either insane all day. Kensington Road runs straight for a while before turning. We lived on the bend, it was there I was raised and fed, counting and running as I go down past the hedges, all in a row. Adelaide, 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 Adelaide. Dad's hands used to shake, but I never knew he was dying. I was 13, I never dreamed he could fall. And all the great aunts red in the eyes from crying. I rang the bell, I never felt nothing at all. All the king's horses, all the king's men cannot bring him back again. Some old guitar. Now where do you go on a Saturday night? I own this town. Spilled my wine at the bottom of the statue of Colonel Light. And the streets are so wide, everybody's inside, sitting in the same chairs that were sitting in last year. Talking about the crows, the crows, all the king's horses, all the king's men wouldn't drag me back again. Adelaide, 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 Adelaide,
And that was Adelaide by Paul Kelly, specially chosen for us today by our guest, Stuart Coop, and we're talking about his new book, Paul Kelly, The Man, the Music and the Life in Between. Stuart, we're going back with that song, Adelaide. It does mention some autobiographical parts. Now, at one point, Paul got together with his band, The Dots, and some people have described it as like Dylan meeting the band. I thought there were some other comparisons there, because people often complain about Dylan's voice, and you mention a woman in Mittagong who didn't like Paul Kelly much either.
Yes, I heard this story and I really loved it, and it just begged to be the opening couple of pages of my book, Bill. The story, very briefly, is that in 1986, about 7 months before Too Long came out, Paul Kelly, and at this stage it was the Coloured Girls were his band, and they were struggling to get crowds. So they were touring as much as they could, and they were down in Mittagong outside of Sydney on a midweek night and playing at the Mittagong RSL, which is a big cavernous RSL club, and they had a terrible sound system which wasn't working properly. It was crackling, and there was noisy, there was feedback. They were having an awful show in a room that would normally hold about 700, including a group of women at the back, standing at the back of the room. And at one point, one of them walked very slowly to the front of the stage. Paul was singing, and she beckoned to the guitar player, Steve Conley, and he put his head down, and she yelled in his ear, "I just want to tell you that my friends and I are leaving now, and we want you to know that you are the worst band we have ever heard or seen, and we are leaving." And slowly she walked back to the back of the room to her group of friends, and they walked out. And so there was then 25 people in the room, and that included bar staff and so forth. So you can have that scenario in December of 85, and then 7 months later you've got an album out with a song like Before Too Long, which peaked at number 14 on the Australian charts and began the trajectory that has led us to where Paul is now. But, you know, we take it for granted. We think, oh, you know, Paul Kelly's always been there and he's successful and popular. But, you know, there were times, you know, when I used to come and see him when he was in the Dots, you know, and, you know, 30, 40 people watching a gig was not uncommon, particularly in those days when he ventured outside of Melbourne and went to other cities.
You mentioned then a backing band called the Coloured Girls. That was clearly not PC, I think, even in those days.
No, look, No, I mean, it's and it would be much less PC these days. No, it was, look, it was a homage to Lou Reed's song, Walk on the Wild Side, and the chorus goes, and the coloured girls go, do-do-do-do-do. And Paul had grown up, he was a big Lou Reed fan, a big Velvet Underground fan. That's where he took it from. It was just his way of saying, well, where are my backing musicians? You know, where are they? Certainly, it was a different time then, Bill, but it didn't raise any hackles in Australia. But when we went to America in 1987, we ended up being signed to A&M Records in Los Angeles, and it didn't take very long for them to say, hey, do you guys want to go and play in the American South? And we said, of course we do. And they said, well, you're going to have to change the name of the band. And that's when Paul came up with the name The Messengers, which is what the band were known as for the majority of the rest of, you know, for the rest of their time together. So yes, it was it was a name that was innocently picked without any real awareness of broader issues, and certainly, you know, issues that are very important and significant now. But it did lead to one of the most amusing experiences I ever had with Paul, because Paul at one point decided he really wanted to play inside Australian prison. So, and he did that many times, but the first show I organised was at Long Bay Jail in Sydney. And we went in one day just before Christmas, and we set up, and, you know, there was a real sense of excitement in the prison. You know, here comes this rock and roll band, and so, you know, Paul and the band start playing, and all of the prisoners are there watching. And after the first song, you know, they don't seem particularly excited. And then by the third song, you know, half of the prisoners are starting to walk back to exercise yards and play basketball and do things like that. And I said to the guard, one of the guards, I said, so, you know, are we doing something wrong here? And he looked at me and he said, mate, you come in here and you advertise yourself as Paul Kelly and the Coloured Girls, and you've got five ugly white guys up there. What do you think's wrong? So I did have to laugh at the time.
You mentioned your role then. You actually managed Paul for a while. How did you come to be the manager?
Look, Bill, it was the very first interview that I ever did. Back in 1977, I'd moved from Launceston to Adelaide. And then we built up a friendship, you know, not a close friendship, but, you know, good enough to, you know, say hi and occasional phone call. And I wrote very favourably about his first two records. And then when he moved to Sydney in 1984, after taking the now, you know, legendary 13 hours on the bus from St Kilda to King's Cross, he called me up and he said, you know, do you want to get together, you know, have a beer, have a bit of a chat? And I said, sure. And we did that. And then during the course of that conversation, he said, would you be interested in being my manager? You know, I'd been managing the Hoodoo Gurus, and, you know, we'd done an American tour, and that relationship was ending. And I said, look, you know, I'd love to be your manager. So we hatched a plan to record the Post album. And then I worked with Paul throughout the 1980s. And then we parted company, you know, as good friends. And I don't, if we hadn't ended working together as good friends, I don't think I would have been writing this book. And here we are, you know, all these years later, and I'm writing a book about him. You know, look, I'm a character in the book, but it's, you know, it's not a book about all my days as Paul Kelly's manager. You know, I'm in there when I need to be in there.
One of the people that you speak to, and you mentioned earlier, is Renee Geyer, and I thought she had an interesting comment that she said, Paul had the ability to write a song that a woman can sing. He knows how a woman feels. That's sort of, perhaps it's a literary thing. I always felt Patrick White could get into a woman's head, but Paul, well, from that comment, Paul can do it as well.
Yeah, Paul writes very wonderful songs for women, and his songs, a lot of his songs sound fantastic when they're sung by women. You know, there is an entire compilation, a collection of Australian women singing Paul Kelly's songs, and it works remarkably well. So he wrote very, very well for Renee Geyer. You know, he writes very good songs that have been sung by, you know, Vicar and Linda Bull. So yes, he does have a knack. It was interesting when Renee said, "Oh, he writes better love songs when he's not in a relationship, and when he's in a relationship, he gets all gooey and he doesn't write so well." And I put that to Paul, and he said, "Well, you know, I haven't exactly spent much of my life not in relationships. So is she saying that most of the time I don't really write good love songs? I'm not sure." But no, he's learned how to write for others, and when he comes up with the right song, and the right voice interprets it, it can be quite remarkable. But yes, he does have a knack of writing songs that women feel drawn to singing if they're looking for words that they haven't written themselves. So it's quite some skill to have.
He also seems to have a skill in getting extremely talented people around him. I mean, his present backing group called The Squad, you've got Vicar and Linda, you've got, I think, the best Australian guitarist that I can think of anyway, in Ash Naylor. It's a very impressive group he's got that just loves playing with him.
Yes, look, I think, you know, he does have very good people around him and very loyal people. And he's got a lot better at, you know, at dealing with bands and working with bands and collaborating with his musicians. And they perform, you know, a terrific function around him. You know, they're a close-knit squad. He calls them a squad, just like a footy squad, you know, picking your team. And Vicar and Linda, obviously magnificent singers. They're a very, very fine collection of people. And, you know, I mean, he's always had terrific guitar players, you know, be it Steve Connolly in the Messengers days, or, you know, for a while his nephew Dan Kelly was playing guitar and still does from time to time. And in, as you say, you know, Ash Naylor, a very, very, very fine guitar player and a lovely human being to go with it. They're good people, and that, I think, is important. If you're going to be part of Paul's world, you need to be low maintenance, good at what you do, fun and enjoyable to be around, and of course, you know, extremely professional, and that's what their characteristics that all of those that those people have in spades.
Paul has had such a varied career, and I'm just wondering, you know, if you've got any idea where he might go next.
Look, I mean, it's staggering how active he is in 2020, Bill. I mean, look, he about a month ago he released his coronavirus, you know, album, let's call it that, but, you know, basically performances that he'd done on social media, for social media, from his home during the initial phase of lockdown. So that came out then, you know, it was only a couple of weeks after that before, you know, his collaboration with Paul Grabowski on sort of jazz-tinged interpretations of Paul's songs was released. So he's working on a Christmas album. He's trying to fit in time to do an album with some members of the band The Drones. I'm sure he's actually going to make another regular Paul Kelly record. So for someone, you know, approaching his mid-60s, or in his mid-60s, I should say, you know, you could not accuse Paul of sitting back and resting on his laurels. I mean, he's more creatively active now with more different projects than he ever has been. So he's very, very active, and look, he can basically pursue anything that that he chooses to. And
I'm sure that with Stuart we could go chatting most of the day, but it's all we've got time for today. I would just like to give a very special thank you, Stuart Coop, author of Paul Kelly. Thank you very much for being a guest on Dad's on the Air.
My absolute pleasure, Bill. Thank you. And I look forward to talking to you again. Hopefully there'll be another book and we'll have another chat.
Oh, that would be great. If you'd like to listen to this show again or any of our shows, go to our website, Dad's on the Air, and we'll be back next week with another show.